I would say this to any senior manager or CEO. There's a difference between being a successful executive and a great one. And the difference is legacy impact. Now, your company may not need to gain the protective evangelism of its culture right today. I mean, you may not need it today. Things may be going very well for you, but you're going to need it one day. Every company needs it someday. And you can't bank this when you need it. You have to earn it ahead of time.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturluson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Art Management. Do we truly understand what culture is and how it works? I'm afraid that too often we don't. And our misconceptions and flawed assumptions can have serious consequences as we fail with our most important change efforts, are unable to drive strategic initiatives, or end up with a toxic environment. I found few people have such an astute understanding of culture as Stan Schlapp. Stan was on this podcast 3 years ago, and we kept in touch and decided that now was the time to get an update on what he's been learning. Stan is the founder of Schlapp Company, a culture consultancy praised by senior executives at companies like Microsoft and Google and Starbucks for helping them succeed with critical change efforts. He's the author of 2 New York Times best-selling books on culture, and I love this title, Bury My Heart at Conference Room B, The Unbeatable Impact of Truly Committed Managers, and Under the Hood, Fire Up and Fine-Tune Your Employee Culture. Stan and I had, as always, a thought-provoking conversation as we discussed what culture is, why we should differentiate between employee culture and management culture, how to assess whether your employee culture is committed to your strategic initiatives, and how you can develop a customer culture that builds a brand. I wanted to get really practical, so I used the case of a multinational company that wants to strengthen a speak-up culture to get Stan's insights into what steps to take to drive that change and get commitment. However, before we begin, this episode is launched on a Maundy Thursday, and I hope I'm saying that right, leading up to Easter weekend. Within the Christian tradition, Maundy Thursday is the day commemorating Jesus washing his disciples' feet and saying, according to the book of Matthew, "You know that the rulers in this world lord it over their people, and officials flaunt their authority over those under them. But among you, it will be different. Whoever wants to be a leader among you must be your servant." To me, and no matter what religious beliefs or persuasions we might have, this day is a beautiful celebration of servant leadership. And I hope that it can serve as a reminder that our motives for leadership matter. And that true leadership begins with a willingness to serve. And conversely, toxic leadership often begins at the point where we convince ourselves that we deserve to be served by the people we lead. But now, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Stan Schlapp and have a great Easter. Stan, it is such a privilege to have you on the podcast again.
I'm honored. Thanks for having me.
So for those of our listeners who haven't heard our last conversation, and I think even for those who did, your definition of culture is so incredibly insightful, and it's really helped shift my perspective on culture. So I really want us to start there. What does culture mean to you?
Well, let me start by saying that culture is the most overused yet often least understood concept in business. It was actually Merriam-Webster's word of the year several years ago, which means that according to the most popular dictionary in the entire English language, culture was the most newly searched for word in the entire English language. Now, in my company, because creating maximum cultural commitment for companies is what we do, we like to say that a banana had made word of the year instead. By now, companies would understand what a banana is and recognize it's not going to peel itself just to feed you. So the definition that we have, which is unique and is proprietary, I at least want to point out first, is that this has been vetted by experts from the Oxford University Department of Anthropology, Pulitzer-winning investigative journalists, research teams for both of my books, and been applied for 25 years in our solutions in 44 countries that have achieved many billions of dollars of measurable impact for companies. So it's unique and it's proprietary, but it's accurate. A culture comes into existence whenever a group of people share the same basic living circumstances. So they naturally band together to confirm the known rules of survival and emotional prosperity. How do we all survive living in the same jungle, in the same tribe, with the same chief, or in the same company, on the same team, with the same manager? And once we know how to protect ourselves, how do we get rewarded emotionally and avoid punishment? But a culture is not beliefs about the way things are around here. That's just the currency of the culture. The culture is an independent organism that obsessively collects this information about its environment, attempts to vet it, and shares it privately amongst itself. A culture is an independent organism living right inside your company with its own purpose and all the power to make or break any management plan and any manager. Its purpose is to protect itself. Now, it will protect the company, but only when it perceives a reliable through line between what happens for the company, what happens for the culture. So it is an independent organism. And once this is understood, a culture's motivations are pure and unchanging, and the strength of its commitment to business success is predictable and correctable.
There's so much there that we could unpack. And I think some important kind of implications that I take out of your definition here is that, one, that when people think that a culture is just the sums of each member's values or something like that, it's clear that it's not. It's something else. It is something that is independent. The other thing I think is that the signals that are transmitted within an organization of what is it that will be encouraged here, what is it that will lead to emotional to our emotional welfare here, are so incredibly important. I want to hear what are some implications that you have seen coming out of this perspective on culture?
Well, I think that the first and perhaps the most important to get culture taken as seriously as it needs to be is that it is a tremendous business asset. If your culture wants something to happen in your company, something's going to happen. If it doesn't want something to happen, nothing is going to happen. I'm asked all the time, so what's the definition of a great culture? And I think people expect me to say, well, it's a happy culture. Yes, you do not want your culture to be actively unhappy. That would not be good for you. But a great culture is a committed culture. And the commitment of your culture is measurable with any metric you use and every metric you use to grow and protect and operate your business. So culture is a business asset. It's a leverageable, measurable business asset. Some of the other implications, once you really begin to understand culture, is because a culture exists to protect itself, its antenna is working constantly, tracking the company, tracking its environment, seeking information. So the antenna is working constantly. A culture's credibility detector is nearly infallible. Its perceptions are alarmingly accurate. Its memory is elephantine. You cannot bribe, bluff, or bully your culture into sustainably believing or doing anything. You can't tell it what to believe. You can't stop it from existing. But you can take great comfort to recognize that your culture is the most rational organism in the world. It only wants to know how to protect itself. So it deals in the real. They may be moved or amused by some attempt to inspire it, but it really just wants to know what is. So it's a rational organism. It's agnostic. Your culture doesn't even mind bad news. It minds whether it can trust who's giving it the news. It's an open system. It is constantly got to be open to recalibrating its beliefs because it's constantly trying to update the known rules of survival and emotional prosperity. So to recognize your culture as well is not anti-business. It's not anti-business. It's not anti-accountability. It's not anti-change. It's not anti-productivity. It's not, but it is definitely anti-unsafe. And anything that your culture perceives as unreliable, undependable, unknown, has got threat potential to the culture, and it will detach itself from any proximity to that. Couple of other things. Whenever we look at a company that's got problems with the commitment of its culture, we can generally trace some of it back to the company officially declaring values, which are kind of the gateway drug to cultural detachment. Values are declared by companies. First of all, it's an unaudited aspirational list. But beyond that, it often combines strategies with actual values. But beyond that, values are presented as absolutes in a company. If you want to look at the very DNA of this company, the uncompromising, unchanging soul of the company is in these three words or these five words and their meaning. Well, because they're presented as absolutes, the culture expects them to be protected, absolutely. And that's never going to happen, even if they're really well thought out and even if the intent is real on behalf of the enterprise. This is a real world. Things happen. And if your culture perceives that what you're saying is most important, that what presented as religious doctrines are not protected religiously, then you've taken the most profound of human concepts, which is a culture, rather, which are values, and you've pitched it to the most profound of human organisms, which is a culture, under perceived false pretenses, and trust is fractured at a very low level. The better thing to do is not to talk values to a culture, is to present them as obsessions. These are the things we are obsessed with in terms of how this business operates. Is it always going to operate that way? What are you, nuts? No, it's not going to always operate that. Do not judge us by whether it always operates according to these obsessions. Judge us by the ferocity of our response if it ever doesn't. And that's not simply a rhetorical distinction. That's a very different way of presenting. A couple other things, and we move on to your 1,001 other questions I'm sure you have. If you want a culture to embrace a process, let's say agile as an example, if you want your culture to embrace agile processes, well, you have to teach those. If you want your culture to embrace a behavior, including the behaviors that would be incumbent in an agile culture, you have to convince it. Behaviors of accountability and flexibility and resilience and innovation, openness to... These are human behaviors, and a culture is a human organism. It already has these behaviors, these latent behaviors. It's just chosen not to give them to you. So trying to teach your culture to do that isn't going to work. You have to understand why your culture is hesitating to give them to you. And finally, to sum up my answer to this question, I think the most important thing about the implications of understanding, really understanding culture, is that your culture will give you whatever you want. You just have to give it what it wants first. And respecting what it wants from you is the difference between its defiance and its compliance.
So many things here that I would just love to spend time talking through. And of course, we don't have that much time in this lifetime, or at least in this interview. But there's just something here. Could we perhaps just try to put this very, very quickly to practice? So let's say we have a multinational company, and they see we have a lot of ethics and compliance leaders listening to this podcast. And let's say they see a need of increasing behaviors of speaking up within their company. They want people to raise concerns when they see behaviors that are out of line, or they see kind of misconduct or different red flags and so on. But its culture is not really giving that to the company currently. Instead, people are silent. So could you say something like, practically, what are some things, if you would try to pick that apart super, super quickly? Of course, you don't know at all the details of this company, but based on your experiences, and I mean, this company could just be any multinational company somewhere in the world that are facing these issues. What are some things that you would say, okay, here are key things to practically ensure to move towards commitment?
Well, first of all, the culture is not silent. A culture lives to communicate. It may not be communicating to you, but it is communicating to itself. when we hear from companies, oh, we did an engagement survey, in which case my first question is, how do you know the culture told you the truth? Well, we don't really know that. But we did an engagement survey, but only 38% of the culture responded. No, 100% of the culture responded. 62% of the culture responded by not responding. And that is definitely a signal. So a couple of things just as level set, and then I'll give you some tactical steps. The first is, don't blame a culture for how it's treated. That's like the dumbest thing a company can do. A culture is just reacting to how it's reading its environment. The second thing is what you want your culture to do and how you want it done and why you want it done is never as important as why not. Given the corporate logic and urgency of any strategic or performance goal, why would your culture not give its full commitment? If your culture is not giving its full commitment, it believes it's not safe and sane to do that. And it believes it has empirical evidence to prove that to itself. And so you have to start there. You have to start, in all fairness and respect to the culture, which is an innocent, pure organism that, again, is just being shaped by whatever ability to accurately interpret its environment to protect itself. It's got evidence that it's not the safe and sane thing to do. So start there. Don't just keep hitting the why, how, what hammer. And when the culture isn't reacting, assume that the culture just doesn't get it. The culture gets it. It's easily as smart as management. It just doesn't understand why it should get up for doing it. So start there. In terms of, is there a one step, two step, three step? The first step is to set context for why you're doing what you're doing. You begin to gain credibility for it. And that context has to be emotional. It has to, you know, with all respect to business metrics, there has to be a greater reason. It has to be really something that the culture believes is really dearly held. So you set context for why you're doing what you're doing. Emphatically and dramatically say, this is what we stand for. So when you're doing things, the culture is able to say without any question, okay, you said this and you're doing this. Okay, we're going to establish a pattern for this. Okay. And you have to maintain a pattern of, we said this and did this. So redundancy is your friend when you're talking to a culture. One of the ways a culture is going to decide whether to pay attention to what you're talking about is how many times you talk about it. Because from the culture's perspective, logical, if you think about it, if you really cared about it, which would mean it's probably important to our survival to pay attention to this, if you really cared about something, you'd never shut up about it. You want to set that initial emotional context emphatically and dramatically. This is what we stand for. So then when you begin to do things, the culture is able to make the linkage for itself between you said this and did that. And you want to continue to do this, because then what you want to do is interrupt the narrative, the culture's narrative. Now, the culture has a story about the way things are around here that it tells itself. It's not necessarily all negative, but a lot of it is because it's self-protective. So the culture would vote no typically before it votes yes. You want to do something or some things that disrupt that narrative for the culture, like legendary acts to prove you really mean what you're saying. So when the culture goes back to the same story it always tells itself, it can't fit this thing into that story. And it is forced to rethink the story. And then what we call invite the pressure test. Even if you said emphatically and dramatically, this is what we stand for, and you then dutifully continued to prove that you mean it and relate your actions back to this declaration of intention, and you did legendary things to prove that you are going to hold to this under the temptation or stress to compromise, you do that for a period of time, say maybe 10 to 12 months, your culture is going to go crazy on you. It's going to act like you never did a single thing you said you were going to do. And actually, if you can interpret this accurately, that's a good thing. It means that your culture has recognized a pattern of linkage between what the company says and what it does, which would make it a dependable place, a safer place, and your culture will protect a safer place for itself. But it's before it increases its commitment, it has to test whether you really mean it. Now, there are not a lot of options for the culture to test this. One of the best ways, the easiest ways for a culture to test this is pretend to walk away. Because if you really didn't mean what you said, and you've been doing it for a year, and the culture said, no, we don't trust this at all, the C-suite of any company, you go, okay, that's enough with this cultural crap. Where you're going back to basics, new program, new plan. It's recognizing what is actually happening here as a pressure test, and then holding firm, because on the other side of that is real increases in commitments. So to recap, set emotional context, emphatic, dramatic declaration of what you stand for that is unchanging and uncompromising. Continue to do things to prove that you mean it and refer back to why you're doing them. So you set a pattern. In there somewhere will be the opportunity to really prove that you mean it. And these legendary acts are necessary to interrupt the culture's narrative, where it can't go back to this is the way things are around here, because it can't fit this legendary thing into that story. And then invite the pressure test and welcome it as soon as you can, because then you're going to get on the other side of it. So in terms of a macro solution that would fit any company in the world, I can tell you.
This is super, super helpful, Vlad, Stan. And I'm just thinking about how important it is to ask the question, why not? And I think so many times as leaders, we don't really want to ask that question. We instead want to kind of create the case of every reason why people should want to do this, but we don't really truly honestly ask the question, why not? Why is this not safe? Or why could this be interpreted that it's not safe? And I'm thinking another point here as well, that you try to do too many things because you aren't going to drive change on 200 things this way, because then you're not going to stay committed. You're not going to keep communicating the same thing. You actually have to be really, really focused on something that is truly important to the company.
And to the culture.
And to the culture. Yes. Yes. So you've talked about the importance of understanding and kind of assessing culture. And we talked on this podcast on that employee engagement surveys are not culture assessments. And I think it would be so interesting just to get some perspective of what is it that you and your company looks at to, and you talked about that you don't necessarily know if the culture told you the truth. So how do you get to the truth?
We have the world's only true cultural analytic. For one thing, it comes from the accurate definition of culture. The way that we try and come up with a summary answer, because we can get at the truth. This is statistically bulletproof data that we're able to present back to a company. One of the things is we do this not from the company's perspective, we do it from the culture's perspective. So we look at what are the categories that a culture would use to decide to protect or reject any company plan? And what are the keys to whether it trusts? How does it take its discretionary energy? Does it trust the people it works for directly and the company's stated values and the executive team? Does it consider the behaviors that you want to be safe and sane? Is performance reinforcement sending the signal that the culture actually needs to translate it into its own ability to affect its safety? The claims that the company makes that the culture has to represent with its own good name to others, does the culture consider those credible? There's a lot of things that the culture looks at and synthesizes when it decides to trust a management message and leverage its full commitment to business success. And that's what we do. We start with measurable business objectives, because when we finish this work with a company, we want to make sure that that the C-suite of any company understands there is a definite connection between causing cultural commitment and causing desired business performance. And we know that if we do this to cause the cultural commitment, we will see it in measurable business performance. So we have to do that. Once we know what we're working with, like you want to be able to get to this measurable point, then what we're going to do is see what your culture is actually going to do about that, because that will have implications for anything you wanted to do. We ask a number of proprietary questions that talk to a culture like it really talks to itself. Because the culture is a closed society. It's not going to reveal to you whether it plans on committing to anything. That can make it vulnerable and exist to protect itself. So we ask those questions that are provocative. They're not positive, leaning questions. This is not an engagement survey at all. This is a true cultural analytic. The other thing is your managers are not part of the employee culture. The rules of survival and emotional prosperity for managers and the sources of information are distinct enough where they are apart from your employee culture. So we also are looking at manager cultures as your manager culture at all levels, as well as your employee culture at all levels. So we're asking the right kinds of questions, and we're asking very provocative, open-ended questions that get tens of thousands of deeply passionate responses. It's a very sophisticated analysis process. There's multiple ways we confirm whether the culture really told you the truth. We get the backstory, whatever strength of commitment your culture has now didn't start now. It could have started 20 years ago. There could have been some incident as genesis of your culture's belief system about the way things are around here that your culture has since looked through that filter. And, you know, if it's looking for something to confirm a belief, it's going to find it. And it could be the culture's hesitation started with an incident that happened before you even joined the company as a manager, as senior management. And the culture has handed that down from one tenured generation to the next. We're able to identify the genesis and the iconic confirmation moment since then that the culture uses to say, no, we're going to sustain this belief system. It's a complex analytic process. It's bulletproof. We do it all over the world. It always causes a culture to tell the truth. And then we show what you do about it, because otherwise it's just management information.
I think something you said there that is so interesting, and I've seen this so many times in organizations, how there is this event. It's in the history of the organization, and the current management might not have been there. And it's still causing something to happen within the culture. I've experienced that several times, and I've really encouraged leaders, because many times I feel like executives are very unwilling to address it. Since we're talking about speak up culture, we could take that example. And for example, that there's been someone, maybe probably a senior executive, who has been very kind of aggressive, destructive in some way, and really, really taught people that is very unsafe to speak up here. And I've encouraged executives, the new executive team, to actually truly address that, and to also acknowledge the damage that it did and the impact that it's had. And I've seen instances where people were incredibly moved by that and how it helped them move forward. But what is something that you've learned in terms of when there are things in the past to be able to move forward and to kind of leave those assumptions behind?
I think that's human behavior in a culture, again, as a human organism, is you have to accurately confront the past in order to reframe the future for yourself. In order to add value to trauma, you have to take lessons from it that can make your life better now. And also, when we do the cultural analytic, we don't stop at a mid-level manager. We do the executive team as a subculture. And in many cases, in some cases, the executive team has booked themselves a honeymoon suite on the good ship Lollipop and everything is fabulous. But in many cases, we also find that there's great unhappiness and dissatisfaction and turmoil amongst the executive team. You know, people jump from the top floors in buildings, not the bottom. It's not necessarily any easier when you get there. But I would say this, when we're talking to the executive team about why you should confront this and then not try and sweep it under the rug, there's a couple things. First of all, well, I'd say to an executive team two things. First of all, you are betting your company's success, regularly betting your company's success, and these days maybe also betting its life on the ability to constantly roll out new strategies, be they internal transformation readiness strategies, external positioning and product and pricing strategies into a fragmented market experiencing unprecedented change. They have to work. And a successful strategy isn't planned well, it's implemented well. It's owned by your employee culture, right? So betting your company's performance on strategies without first confirming your culture's commitment to achieving, protecting, and evangelizing them is kind of like committing CapEx or OpEx money without first confirming your bank balance, cash flow, or line of credit. It's just like covering your eyes and rolling the dice. But also, there is a difference. I would say this to any senior manager or CEO. There's a difference between being a successful executive and a great one. And the difference is legacy impact. Now, your company may not need to gain the protective evangelism of its culture right today. I mean, you may not need it today. Things may be going very well for you, but you're going to need it one day. Every company needs it someday. And you can't bank this when you need it. You have to earn it ahead of time. So confronting these issues, resolving this, sustainably creating the knowledge and awareness and the tools for achieving maximum cultural commitment is not just a matter of performance, of achieving performance, a matter of achieving performance insurance. Even if you are not in the company any longer when that performance insurance is required, or at least to be earned on your watch, you just fix the future of the company. That is legacy impact. That's a great executive and a great executive team. So there's a number of reasons to do what you're suggesting.
Yeah, really, really helpful. And there's another thing that I think about in as we're having this conversation, and that is, for example, if we look at Silicon Valley, where companies have been generally known for having kind of lavish benefits for their employees and stuff like that. And now there have been several companies that have taken some things away and saying, okay, we need to operate in a different way now. And it has led to, I think Google is one example of kind of quite a lot of pushback from employees. And I mean, I think that lavish benefits are not the key to a great culture. In this case, organizations and nonprofits could never have a great culture. But when it comes to the culture feels like something is being taken away, is there something that is really important to reflect on in that process?
I think that what you're saying is so true. Companies regularly overestimate, and this is the difference between employees and an employee culture. An employee culture is not a bunch of employees. It is this independent organism that's created when a bunch of employees share the same basic living circumstances. Companies regularly overestimate the importance of money to an employee culture. And let's say money and all the perks that go along with it. It's not that employees care about money more than anything else in some cases, if that's what's presented. An employee culture has different set of priorities. It's concerned about its survival and its emotional prosperity, not its physical prosperity. So what a culture really wants to know is the meaning of the money. The culture wants to know, if I do this that you're telling me to do and the way you're telling me to do it, and I get recognized for my good performance, does that mean I'm safer in some way? And the culture hates to have to sweat to figure that out. For one thing, it already had to sweat to do the work, but also it could get it wrong. There's many companies, talk about Silicon Valley, that you could do a great job in Q1 and your job could move to Bangalore without you in Q2. So there's not necessarily... So what your culture cares most about is not the money. And it's not even what the money buys. It's what the money can't buy. And in general, in life, the most valuable things are what money can't buy. What your culture is looking for is a connection between recognition of good performance and increased safety. And so if you have to take things away, all the perks and stuff, but you leave that, you've left the most important thing to the culture anyway. We can directly affect our safety, our survival, and emotional prosperity through our good work. And if you aren't doing that, if you're just throwing a bunch of perks, do that anyway. Again, there's a difference between the way employees would look at compensation and performance reinforcement and the way an employee culture would look at it.
This is so insightful. And you're writing a new book, and I can really recommend people to go and buy your current books. But you're writing a book on customer culture. And I think that is such a fascinating topic. And what are some, if you would just shortly say, some kind of the key insights that you've gained during that process?
Well, about half the work we do is on the customer culture side. And to make it very clear, three groups for everybody listening to this podcast, three groups are deciding the success of your company while you are listening to me speak this sentence. They are your manager culture, your employee culture, and your customer culture. And really the key to gaining the maximum commitment of your customers is understanding them as a customer culture. And they are a customer culture because what your customers have in common is a dependent relationship with your company. That puts them in the same jungle, in the same tribe, with the same chief. So then all of the rules of understanding how to maximize the commitment and gain the protective evangelism of your customer, of a culture, come into play for you. If you're just looking at customers, you don't get any of that stuff. The ultimate commitment your customer culture can give you is if it brands you. And a brand is not a verb. You can't brand your company. It's not a claim. You can't call yourself a brand. It's a tribute. given to you by your cultures, both in your internal culture and your external culture. And if you are going to, if you want to be a brand, the real reason you would want to do this, that you'd want to achieve this trust, is what a brand does is it transfers sustainability of a company to its customers. If you're a brand, your customers advertise and sell for you, and they protect you if you stumble or get attacked. So if you want to be a brand, first of all, you have to have some sort of brand promise that says you will know this company by its intention. Then you have to convince your customers. Basically, you have to convince your internal and external cultures of something that they can't possibly be convinced by. It's impossible for them to be a, because they have to be able to say, we can trust you when you tell us you care. And there's no way that your customer culture would understand whether this is a campaign or you're trying to distract it from previous or planned heinous moves, or and your employee culture has to represent, wouldn't know either. So your culture, if you want to be a brand, your culture can't just trust you, your customer culture, your internal culture. It has to give you the deepest level of trust possible. It has to give you faith. And faith is, I believe, but I don't know. And this is to give you that unfounded trust is the rarest thing a culture will ever give you. And that's how we got into this business, because that's what we know how to get from a company's culture. So I would say that every company sells two things. You sell a product, and then you sell the process, the experience a company customer goes through to buy and use that product. In the mind of a customer culture, it's a quality of the process that does much, sometimes most, in a hyper-competitive market, sometimes all, to determine a customer's decision to purchase, repurchase, and recommend to others. So even if you get an A on the product, if you get an F on the process of buying the product, you're still a C player. Maybe you'd say nobody'd ever give you an F on the process, but unless the quality of your customer experience is spectacular, not ordinary, polite, and friendly, but blow your customers out of their socks, signature aspects of your customer experience I can only get by being your customer, and sustained, manageable, and affordable inside, so consistently delivered outside, nobody's going to give you an A either. I would say that traditional business thinking is you go to market based on value, and the better your value prop is, the more successful you're going to be in this day and age of a global marketplace. Pretty much anybody, B2B or B2C, anybody wants to buy anything can buy anything from almost anywhere in the world. So given that, and the danger of commoditizing your offerings, and also all the channels of feedback about the customer experience that the culture can talk to the culture, to just go to market based on value alone, you are definitely going to be entering a margin shredding commodity battle. The companies that will be most successful in the future are the ones that go to market based not just on value, but relevance. And I don't mean relevance as another spin on value. There's a lot of things going on in your customer's world. If you only choose to be relevant to them when you're trying to sell them something, you're choosing to be irrelevant to them for most of the time. And that is a very dangerous business strategy.
Thank you so much for that, Stan. And there's one belief that is so vital for me, and it's what I write about in my coming book. And it is that the health of a culture is not mainly built by short-term initiatives. And that's what companies typically do, HR initiatives, sometimes ethics and compliance initiatives. We'll do some workshops, we'll invite a speaker or redefine our values. But it really comes down to habits, and it's the things we repeatedly do, the things that repeatedly send signals, which will communicate to the culture if it is safe. And there, I think that leadership habits are really critical. I think while it doesn't end with leadership, I think it needs to start there. And I wanted to ask you, what are some leadership habits or habits that you consider vital to really building commitment and building sustaining cultural health?
I also have written extensively about this. My first book was about Bury My Heart at Conference Room B. It's what we do, a lot of this work in companies all over the world. And where we start with this is that first to recognize that leadership is meaningless. Now, what leadership provides, that's very important. And if you've ever wondered why as a manager you are constantly preached at and screeched at about leadership, why it's always embedded in your job description and 4,100 perfect behaviors of a leader that you're supposed to, where does that come from? It comes from the one thing that companies want the most from their managers, which is emotional commitment. A manager's emotional commitment is worth more than their financial, intellectual, and physical commitment combined. A manager's emotional commitment translates to them taking on company success like a personal crusade, solving problems that are unsolvable, creating energy when all the energy's been expended, and igniting emotional commitment in others. The people who can do that are the people who are called leaders and throughout history. So leaders are people who have emotional commitment to a cause and can inspire it and will in others. And that is really what leadership is all about. Emotional commitment in any human being comes from their ability to live their own deepest personal values in any relationship or environment. So for managers, that would mean the relationship with their company and the environment at work. And manager may be a great job to have. You may be having a great time doing that job, but embedded in every manager's job description is a constant requirement to subordinate or compromise personal values in favor of company priorities. I'm not suggesting you're out there committing heinous acts as part of some Faustian bargain, although even if you are, listen up. What I am saying is what the company wants done and how it wants it done must regularly take precedence over your own deep priorities. And you put a person in a position like that and it causes them to detach. And most managers are in an unknowing state of emotional detachment, having had to bargain with themselves, how do I stay sane and still be successful? The cost of that is my emotional detachment. These are big subjects, but basically a leader is somebody who knows exactly who they are. They actually could put a name on their core values. And because of that, they know exactly where they want to go. They want to go to a place where their values are being fully realized. Now, they can't make that happen without the support of other people. So the process that is called leadership is translating my personal values into something of urgent benefit for you. So you will help me meet my values. I mean, if a manager knew who they were, or a leader knew who they were, knew where they wanted to go and knew how to get there, they'd just go. They'd send you a postcard from the promised land. I have a dream. You're not in it, but they need you. So first of all, where this starts is allowing your managers to bring their deepest personal values to work and not seeing that as a threat to the company. If a manager can turn their job into a mechanism for meeting their deepest personal values, that's the source of their ferocious commitment to keeping the company safe and successful. When it comes to the implication of that to those who work for those leaders, that's a whole different thing. If a leader is able to say, these are my deepest personal values. I had these values before I joined the company. I'm going to have them long after I leave the company. And here's what it means to you. Then what you've done is given the gift of the gods to your employee culture. You've given them the key to survival in your world. You are saying, I am here. Put yourself in safe orbit around me. Protect what's most important to me, and you're going to be okay. Step on this, and it's going to be a very bad day for you. I mean, most management messages that are delivered to an employee culture, no matter how elegantly or expensively they are delivered, whether it's on a small screen in their hand or the big screen on some in some company offsite, are just equations that end only one way, equals work harder. Any real leadership message delivered to an employee culture is also a message that ends only one way, an equation rather that ends only one way, which is equals live better. Now, your employee culture is not going to work any harder unless it's convinced it will allow it to live better. The same thing that goes for you as a manager. You will never really work for your company unless your company really works for yours. And so I would say, to synthesize the 8 years it took me to write my book, the 25 years we've been doing this, into one of your insipid questions to that, I would say that forget all the talk about leadership. Get to why leadership is so important in the enterprise. It is gaining the sustained emotional commitment from your manager culture. You will not do that unless your managers can bring their deepest personal values to work. And unless they're protected, unless the company is confident, that will actually cause their managers to protect the company and its goals. And it will. When it comes to leaders themselves getting results out of employees, leaders have to translate those personal values into something of urgent benefit, a better way to work. This is based upon what life has taught me is the best way to live. This is the way we're living. It doesn't work. I'm not going to allow it in my life. I'm not going to have you, people I'm close to, have to do without the benefit of the way we could live based upon these values, family, whatever your values are. This is the way we're going to work here together. And this is what's important to me. And that is what will cause a culture to begin to pay attention to this. So it's got the key to survival in your world. And you've just translated your values into the promise of better working conditions for the entire culture.
That was a fascinating answer and a fascinating end to a fascinating conversation. And Stan, what are ways that people can connect with you and learn more about your work?
Well, our company is slapcompany.com, slapcompany.com. If you want to reach me personally, my personal email is stan@slapcompany.com. You know, my commitment to you, so to those on this podcast, goes beyond this podcast. So if I can ever answer any questions for you or recommend solutions, they can be, those things can be distinct, or they can be one leads to the other. But either way, I'm happy to do that. Just reach out.
Stan, I appreciate you so much. I appreciate your being generous with your insights, with your learning, sharing your brain and your experience. So thank you so much.
Likewise. Happy to help.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.